This episode of AVXL was recorded on June 1st, 2017. We're going to talk automatically turning SDR content into HDR, short throw projectors, Plex Live TV, true QLED panels, answer the question, is stereo enough? And we got an interview with Odyssey co-founder and CEO Sankar Thiagasamudram, where we're going to talk about how you take great big planar magnetics and shrink them down. This is some fun stuff, people. Thank you so much for joining us on AVXL.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content. We love projectors, beautiful 4K and 1080p televisions, great speakers, amazing headphones, and making sure you get the most out of your experience no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
We're excited to be here.
Of
not like
course.
Last week.
I know. Strange episode.
Strange and wondrous episode. Oh, my goodness. Normally, we talk about what we're watching at the end of the show, but I just want to say right now, my wife has completely taken over the projector because season 5 of House of Cards came out.
Oh, cool.
So when she passes out trying to finish watching the season tonight, I'm going to throw on Zombieland. I'm just laying
sure.
that out there.
I've seen season 4. I need to go back and refresh. I really don't remember what the hell happened toward the end of that. I mean, it got appropriately crazy. And then real life kicked in. It was far more entertaining.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
It's going to if she says it's good,
it
may be better than reality.
It's certainly more twisted than reality.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Oh, my goodness. Getting back to the primary subject of our podcast, Plex Live TV is now a thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is this acting as a DVR on your Plex box?
They've had that feature for a while now. So what they've added now is the ability to access the tuners on your local network or however you are driving it and actually be able to watch live programming. And while you're watching that live programming, be able to schedule things like recordings and do all the other stuff you expect with a DVR. This, in my opinion, really does bring it one step closer to what Windows Media Center was for a lot of people who are looking to build their own PC or a system that can handle delivering their live TV content, recording it, managing it, and getting it to the devices you want to see. And anyone with the Plex account currently, either the $5 a month plan or the $40 a year plan or the $120 for lifetime plan has access to this new feature. And the only thing lacking now compared to what Media Center was doing is cable card access.
Right.
And unfortunately, I wonder if anyone is really still interested in a cable card systems. It seems like it's a lot of work to get something that doesn't give you the full functionality of a standard set-top box. And I'm thinking of something like Comcast's X1 platform. Nowadays, the only thing Comcast is really lacking, or any of the set-top boxes I see, are support for things like Chromecast or casting to the device or having more apps built into it. That kind of ability is really the one thing they're lacking. And the people at Plex, at least, are giving you everything now in a great package that's compatible across a variety of OSs. That the only thing lacking would be cable card support for access to premium content on a cable network. Otherwise, if you have over the air and that's your primary source, you now have a terrific way to just blend that into your setup as far as Plex goes.
I mean, it's tough when you talk about cable card. The cable card rule, right, is what they called it, where to oversummarize, essentially, if you asked for a cable card, in theory, your cable company was supposed to give it to you, right?
I had never had a problem not getting one.
Yeah.
And they were often, either the first one was free or stupid cheap, like $1 or $2 a month.
Yeah.
So, and with that card, that's the media key, basically. You could tie into an adapter in a computer that would provide all the channels except for pay-per-view. So if you had premium channels like HBO or Showtime or things like that, you'd get all of that. You'd get a regular all the channel lineup you normally would receive on a computer platform that you could then use as your cable box or whatever. But, yeah, this isn't that.
Yeah.
This is the one thing it's lacking. And I don't think cable card support is as important as it may have been 10 years ago.
Well, part of it was, right, from, like, you know, the cable card rule, which was in effect, I think, what, from 2007 till the Satellite Television Extension and Localism Act reauthorization got signed at, like, the end of 2015.
Ah, they legislated it away.
Well, what they legislated away was that, you know, cable, I'm trying to think of, like, I'm trying to think of the easiest way to summarize this, and basically comes down to
where they were required to provide one, and now they're not.
Well, the set-top boxes had to have separable security. Right.
Oh.
So, like, the, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and once you set it up so that the security has to be in the set top box, then you have to have a set top box to have access to cable.
For most people, cable card's not important.
Yeah.
It was an additional hassle that it, in the end,
yeah,
a small majority of us loved it and used it because it gave us the ability to really create your own cable DVR. And avoid, perhaps at the time, excessive payments for just simply renting that box every month. And for things like back in the day when they had 500 gig hard drives as a premium option on your DVR, where you had like 2 terabytes or more storing the whole season. Those are the reasons you build your own DVR. And if you are an over-the-air enthusiast, Plex has really stepped up now to the point where it'll do everything in terms of, it's already been a DVR. Now it'll do your live TV.
Yeah. I mean, Silicon Dust is still amazing.
Oh, no. Yeah, and those are well-supported.
The Home Run Connect, the Home Run Prime, the Home Run Extend.
I love those products. I own many of them. And they're cable card tuners. There's nothing like a network tuner because that allows you to place that anywhere in the home. And the beauty of that is you put it where the best reception is, and as long as you have a network connection to that antenna box, you're good to go. And, you know, being able to do that's pretty easy. And that flexibility of antenna placement's key for just getting good reception if you are doing the over-the-air. And speaking of over-the-air, the next-gen broadcast standard is actually getting a little bit closer. I was predicting around 2019 for something called ATSC 3 to finally drop.
Right.
And that will bring, effectively, 4K streaming, broadcasting, over the air with digital tuners that can receive it, effectively replacing the current system we have right now that does up to effectively 1080i. And South Korea will be among the very first countries to go live with their 4K broadcasting standard using ATSC 3. I believe they are hosting the upcoming Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. So that's probably a reason why they're so quick to be deploying this. I have seen, actually, LG demoing a wireless ATSC 3 tuner, network tuner. So just like we were talking about, this would be a product that not only is a network tuner, but it's also wireless. So you wouldn't even have to worry about connecting it hardwired to a network unless you wanted to.
Right.
This would give you a good option for that.
Oh, my goodness. Something I just want to mention. I finally found out this is an article from, I want to say, 2014. And cable cards still, you know, support it, right? Yeah, I think it's going to be a while before the sort of the next generation phases in and the equipment gets upgraded. But National Cable and Telecommunications Association said that of the 47 million set-tops supplied by the country's 9 largest MSOs, only about 616,000 are using cable cards in the devices. So
what has really destroyed that at this point is the apps and the streaming platforms you have available for live TV programming from everyone. There's a handful now that are decent. So that's even less of a reason to pay attention to a cable card platform at this point, when you can get your premium cable channels now over a decent internet connection.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the demarcation line of it all is, do you have good internet access or not, or affordable good internet
access? Well, okay. I have pretty good internet access.
As far as flexibility.
Yeah, in terms of flexibility. But the other problem is, you know, I've been watching, you know, HBO Now, compressed as snot.
I would like to see your network set up and check to make sure everything's right on your back end, because you shouldn't be having these streaming issues.
I also live in a very densely populated neighborhood with a...
Even so?
Yeah, I'm getting... I mean, I've got bandwidth, but I see a lot of... You know, I see a lot of compression. I'm also watching on a 100-inch screen, so any compression artifacts
shows up.
Be,
noticeable. When I'm watching compressed sports delivered over the internet, I anticipate it ramping up to the max resolution sooner than later.
Well, the other thing is, like, you know, at 2 in the morning, not too bad. At 9 o'clock at night, when everybody in my neighborhood is apparently watching streaming video, that's when I'm seeing the compression artifacts and stuff.
Definitely let them know about it, because that sounds like they've got a bottleneck somewhere.
Well, it just so happens I'm getting a new wireless internet provider installed in about a week.
Very cool.
So I'll let Comcast know.
That's the only power you really have, is to walk away.
Oh, my goodness. And so few people have that option. Toshiba announced a new OLED that...
Holy cow.
Not sure if it'll make it in the United States.
I will say, back in the day, some of the most impressive TVs right out of the box were always Toshiba's. Their LCDs, their tube TVs, everything had a factory calibrated preset that was just downright great. So, they are jumping on the LG OLED bandwagon and providing their own version. Apparently, this will only go into European markets currently.
Right.
I don't see an announcement bringing this to the U.S. The price is on the high end, so that would indicate to me that these will be premium sets.
It's like 55-inch, 65-inch. That's the article up on flatpanelshd.com. In Japan, selling for 700,000 to 900,000 yen, which is corresponds, and I quote Rasmus Larsen, to roughly $6,000 and $8,000 U.S.
Yeah.
So these are not inexpensive.
Not at all. And everyone will directly compare anything at the moment, as far as OLED goes, to what Sony's doing in particular with their video. Everyone's doing great contrast, great color. But when it comes to the video processing side, Sony's extra magic that they're adding to their OLEDs seems to be at the top of the peak right now in terms of... if you're looking for the very best, that's one to focus on. So if this pricing's accurate, it's probably list pricing, of course, but I expect this then to be in that range of performance. It should be at the top.
It should look glorious.
I can't wait. I hope it makes its way over. You know, more OLED options hopefully bring cheaper prices eventually, but that's wishful thinking right there.
I was going to say, given that I think LG is selling every panel, OLED panel they can build right now,
I'm thinking we need competing technologies.
Which we have from Samsung, who has not chosen to use OLED in their televisions.
No, LCD for the time being. But get this, at the end of last month, today being June 1st, it was the SID, the Society of Information Displays Convention. And this is where some of the very latest display technologies are demonstrated for press and for the scientists that work on this stuff. And BOE is a company that makes not only OLEDs on their own production lines, but LCDs as well. They demonstrated something they're calling a true QLED. And they demonstrated two active panels, a 5-inch and a 14-inch panel, actually using quantum dots that were emitting light.
So there's no backlight.
No backlight at all. Direct emissive QLED. Not the Samsung branding of QLED that refers to LCDs with a quantum dot filter with a blue backlighting system. This is effectively the difference between something that is being struck by photons in order to emit light, the way all current LCDs with quantum dot enhancement are doing. They're taking a blue light, converting some of that into very pure green and red. This is, in essence, electroluminescent, where you're stimulating the individual materials with electricity just to have them glow directly. And very, very similar to what OLED currently does in terms of its design and function. And, of course, they are looking to substitute this material for OLED material, specifically for being inorganic versus organic. Excuse me. With OLED materials, the main issue is that if you drive them super hard, you'll age them faster. They're not as robust as an inorganic material would be. So being able to switch over and hopefully eventually substitute an effective material made of quantum dot for the organic light emitting diode materials, you could then see emissive displays pushing well beyond 1,000 nits, perfect color, and all of that. However, we're at the science stage on this right now.
Right.
I am actually surprised anyone has demonstrated a panel at all, let alone a 5-inch display with 320 by 240 resolution.
Yeah. These are very early prototypes.
Science. It's more surprising to see somebody show up and show this actually functioning. I'm curious to know if these were active displays or if they were just like static images. And hopefully they were active. But the key thing,
electroluminescent quantum dot technology.
I'm telling you, it requires for this material to become down the road something that we see in products. It's going to require it to go through some significant chemistry and stabilization in order to make it something you could directly substitute for OLED material.
Right.
Samsung is the oddball here, not the oddball in any bad sense. They are the ones who have claimed that they are going to unveil a quantum emissive display in the next 3 years. So I don't see the current work on these materials and displays as being ready in 3 years.
Right.
So Samsung probably has something else similar to this, but with their own design and flavor. And I'm going to throw it out there and say maybe around the 2020 CES, we will see probably an 8K quantum emissive display on the show floor. So I'll throw that out there. But yeah, we're still in the science phase, but the very fact that they're showing off something that can truly challenge what the OLED folks are doing in terms of the chemistry, in terms of making light,
right,
direct emissive.
Well, should eventually challenge like you said, I mean, this is super early.
What they're showing now is at least 5 years
out. A proof
of
concept, but it's probably a better phrase for this than a prototype.
And it's impressive to see them actually show this publicly. That I find fascinating. And I am itching to see what Samsung has cooking up in their laboratories as well.
We got a great tweet from at Tom Prosima. At Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, at AVXL, I would love to hear your take on an Ars Tech article re-converting SDR to HDR. So I'm just going to kind of read the tagline for this. Quote, we can now convert every film and TV show from the last 80 years into HDR. SDR to HDR converter conjures up more color contrast out of images. And there's about 7 things I immediately thought of in the first couple of paragraphs of this article. Is one, this is university science. Two, this is not upscaling. This is taking available color data and converting it into more color, which is bleeding edge.
To do it well, yes.
Yes, to do it at all.
Anybody can flip into the vivid mode on their TV,
right,
and experience a wider color palette with content that wasn't properly authored for it.
And we've seen...
And it doesn't look right.
Yeah, and how many times have we seen blue? I mean, Patton, like, you know, let's just take all the detail out of the faces, make everybody look like a Ken doll. I'm exaggerating slightly, but you know, the other thing I thought is, like, we can't convert every film and TV show from the last 80 years because a lot of the film and TV shows have been lost.
That's part of the issue. And this French research institute, BCOM, they have come up with a way to help automate the process of doing this conversion, of taking content we have and making it something is optimizing it as best as possible for the best displays today. And they've come up with a way to do this in an automated fashion. And I think that's really the key of what they've come up with here. They're looking at, in this automated process of extracting what they call lighting styles. Mm-hmm. And they're using 5 types at the moment on a frame-by-frame basis. They're looking at effectively the darkest details stepped up to the brightest details separated out. And then they fine-tune this blending of that information. And in essence, they're trying to expand that original 0 to 100 nits that we've been using for 50, 60, 70 years now in broadcast up to that 0 to 1,000 nits, say, for the best TVs today. And, you know, the spec for HDR goes up to 10,000, but maybe that's, you know.
Right.
That's probably pushing it a little too far too quick. Now, the trick of this luminance expansion is to do it without introducing errors or making it look worse. Generally, if you just simply blow out the brightness in an image, it washes out. So part of their magic is to look at the colors, and you're going to have to make some adjustments in order to produce an image that looks good. And it will not be 100% artistically pure.
And that's an interesting point. The article, which is on ArsTechnica.com, we'll have a link in the show notes up at AVXL.com. Sebastian Anthony wrote it up for Ars Technica. It's a really good read because one of the things he talks about is, quote, accurate color reproduction via tone mapping and gamut mapping, altering the colors and brightness of an image so that they appear correctly on a certain type of display is a mature and well-understood topic. Tone and gamut expansion, however, taking one shade of red, for example, and expanding it into multiple different shades is a new topic with not much research behind it. And what's kind of crazy about this is,
it's effectively saying if you had a camera that you shot a beautiful brand new red Ferrari with,
right,
and it recorded it in the old format, and the actual color of that red, it was never captured properly to begin with. Mm-hmm. And now you've developed this automated system using ASIC chips currently, looking at these specific characteristics of each scene to then expand not only the luminance, but to push the color out a little bit further, but without right. making it look bad or weird in any way, or introducing things like banding artifacts. One key thing they have done, though, is with this technique is to actually optimize it, put it in front of real-life viewers, both experts and regular people, and hammer away at it until they came up with a generalized function that would apply to all the video they were able to run through it. And as you were just mentioned, considering how few films are going to be restored,
right,
let alone converted to digital and given the best treatment in the world, mm-hmm. either for a James Bond movie or any favorite, this tool is likely a very good thing for right. broadcasters in general. Now, the output on this, they're looking at doing mostly into the hybrid log gamma format, mm-hmm. which is great because it turns out with things like HDR10, apparently the metadata information is delivered at the very beginning of the programming. So if you came into, if it were a live broadcast right. and you didn't see that first few seconds, you wouldn't have the appropriate the TV would not have the appropriate information to display that content properly. HLG is an interwoven, you could think of it as, information system. So no matter where you pick up the stream, you'd be able to get an HDR quality feed out of it. And it's backward compatible for older TVs too. So this seems pretty cool. And right. I think it's going to be a good thing. And I think it's going to be a way a lot of places that are just like, we're going to have a 4K channel.
Right.
We're going to take all the content we have and at least make it look as good as possible.
Well, I mean, that's also interesting because so many, you can, roughly say that, standard definition television, of which there is a metric ton, or for that matter, 4x3 movies. If you have a 4x3, movie and you telecine it, then you have, let's say they're probably doing that at 4K now, right? And then, the classic, the benchmark for all film restorations would be The Wizard of Oz, where they did
exactly.
an 8K, 8K, telecine and manually aligned. They basically like all three Technicolor strips to do the three colors, and then worked with people who were actually alive back when it came out to figure out what the colors were supposed to look like, and manually aligning all three frames and correcting it and dealing with, it's tough because when you have a movie, right, are there scratches on the frame? Is there damage? Is there dust? That was like the we laugh about it still. The original, the first three Blu-rays that came out because they needed Blu-rays to demonstrate the first Blu-ray player. It was like they took a distribution print and, threw it at somebody and said, turn this into a Blu-ray, because we were sitting there like, there's scratches, there's hairs,
yes.
it's frustrating because
it magnified the issues.
Yes, it magnified the issues. So with that, with film, you've got a transfer that's probably not too bad. But what's going to happen with all of this? I'm going to put my brackets up here and say 480p standard definition content, and how are we going to upscale that? Because it's tough. 480p, especially like I think there's a ton of like children's cartoons and older television shows where they did a pretty weak capture back in the day, and they've never bothered to update that. I'm looking at you, Netflix.
And this BCOM system has the potential to at least improve the contrast of the picture that
right.
you see, in addition to expanding that color palette in a way that's inoffensive. And I think that's going to be great. If you look at film stock
right.
and what the potential performance is of it, I mean, old school film. It is incredible in terms of its color capture and potential dynamic range. That's why if you have the time, money, and resources to take a movie like your favorite classic, get a hold of those original negatives, clean them up a little bit, but you can go back and effectively create HDR content out of that that looks as good as anything today. But that's you know, going back to the original source. Now, this tool from BCom, I'm seeing it with a library of content a broadcaster may already have, and they're looking to enhance that a little bit, juice it up for the eyeballs of their 4K customers. And they probably offer it on a channel that's calling it 4K and so forth and so on. So I really like this, but don't ever I wouldn't see this technique being used, the BCom's technology being used. Well, maybe it would be used on film in some ways. If you're,
I don't know,
just, well, a quick and dirty way.
Yeah, I just
not quick and dirty, but
I mean, there's a lot of. Yeah, no, I think for me, it's like, this is awesome that they're doing this really fancy thing with color, but boy, there's so many television programs I'd like to see. I'd like to see somebody sample them in a way that they don't automatically look like ass on a 1080p screen.
And the potential for the system too is that it is effectively software, and right. and. The impressions that their expert viewers and the traditional regular viewers came up with in terms of fine-tuning the system could go back and readjust that if needed. But it seems like they have a good system for taking a lot of the dirty work out of at least the grunt content that's out there, or the bulk content that's out there. And but when it comes to that film stock, always remember that even compared to the very best, like Red Epic cameras today that can do amazing contrast capture, dynamic range, everything. Those are now just starting to beat what film has been capable of all along.
For approximately forever.
Yeah.
My goodness. So at Tom Prossman, we are excited. We wait. And, you know, we also want to see, I would like to see somebody do something amazing like this in terms of scaling standard definition content.
That's an important, I will throw it out there. Some of the better reviewers I pay attention to actually do pay attention to how well these 4K TVs will scale 480p through, you know, up to 4K. Shouldn't require any scaling with 4K, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
Scaling is important.
Mikkel emailed ask@avxl.com. He says, I've decided to jump into the wonderful world of speakers and AV receiver units with a combination of Elax Unify UF5 speakers and a Yamaha RX V781. With that also comes the immediate fear of not doing it right and making a bad investment. So my question is, are stereo speakers enough in this day and age? Am I, as a person with a house that is not large, getting myself into a disappointment by not getting good surround sound, or is stereo good enough, so to speak? You know, man, there's a lot of ways to skin this particular cat. I think the first thing to say is that any stereo speakers, any quality stereo speakers, and those Unify UF5, that's the floor standing version of Elax Unify speakers, are just going to be a righteous, ass-kicking, joyous, magnificent, monster, huge jump over any speaker that is in a television.
Without a doubt.
No matter how good you think the speakers are in your television, they suck.
They are. They are the weakest link.
Weakest link. And, you know, I'm also going to say is, you know, just going to high-quality stereo reproduction up from the speakers in your television, Mikkel, is a huge improvement. It is engrossing and engaging and compelling. And, by the way, these speakers are going to sound fantastic with music. They're going to sound fantastic with soundtracks.
I find for dialogue too. Stereo reproduction gives you some of the most clear dialogue that you're going to hear from, even if it's a 5.1 broadcast. You know, it just makes it easier to comprehend.
That AVR you've picked out, that Yamaha RX V781, it's kind of overkill for two speakers. But here's the thing: you're going to have room to grow over time. And unlike most stereo amps, you can get HDMI audio pass through from your various boxes. It's going to switch between all of, you know, if you have an Apple TV, Roku TV, Xbox, PlayStation 4, you know, Blu-ray player, whatever you have in there. If you just went with like a stereo amplifier, most stereo amplifiers don't actually offer a dedicated output to a subwoofer. which I consider a flaw, but, you know, that's a whole nother conversation for another day.
I'm pretty sure he has one on this one. So.
Yeah, he has everything on this. This is a 7.1 AVR that supports, like, Atmos.
The hang-up I have with Yamaha AVRs, and hopefully they have since fixed this, but I have one from not that long ago, and when it comes to doing ARC support, I found that I still had to connect an optical cable and bring it back from the TV because the amp has this nasty habit of doing it correctly initially and then about 10 seconds later switching out to this AV input and losing the audio connection. So I got tired of that little quirk and fixed it by just simply adding the optical link to the thing it was already automatically switching to anyway. So if you do run into that with Yamaha products, that is a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea why that still occurs. Hopefully it doesn't. Hopefully it's gone. Hopefully what I'm talking about is history. But
oh, my goodness.
Absolutely nothing. And you're right. He has room to expand down the road for, you know, if you find those two speakers aren't providing the boom, add that subwoofer.
I mean, if you watch a lot of movies, a lot of action flicks, the first thing I would add to a stereo speaker setup, especially those are nice stereo speakers. They've got really good solid low end down to about 40 hertz. But the first thing I would add is a really kick-ass subwoofer.
And the beauty of an AVR, too, is that in these in particular, they'll include that calibration microphone, which will listen for whatever you connect. Two speakers plus a sub. Right. Just the two speakers, a two speaker plus a center channel. However you have it, it will listen to that, configure it all, hopefully, and verify that it's all wired properly, and make it really easy. So then it will know that, oh, you only have two, three speakers. I am going to convert everything I receive into a format that will make these two speakers or three speakers sound great.
And then you can turn around over time and you know, you can add a center channel, you can add surrounds, you can add Atmos speakers, or quite frankly, just stick with the two speakers or a 2.1 setup, two speakers and a subwoofer. Oh, seriously, it's like
network audio streaming, all of it. You have some features there for a lot of cool functionality.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have a fantastic musical experience, you're going to have a fantastic television experience, you're going to have a fantastic
I use AVRs as the hub. Yeah. So one output to the TV, and then everything else gets plugged into the AVR.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're ready or if you have some extra cash, you can be like, hey, I'm going to get a subwoofer. Hey, you know what? I'm going to buy a couple of speakers, throw them on the rear surround channels and be like, this is amazing. Or, so I can feel the Hulk jumping over my head. Meh.
Oh, yeah.
Or you can be like, I feel the Hulk. You know, there's this amazing
some air.
Master and Commander, like one of the opening season, where the ship is like all the noises of the ship kind of creaking around you or the cannon battles.
They won an Academy
and stuff.
Award for the audio on that movie. Pretty sure.
You are in the delete expletive. You are in the stuff.
That is the disc you can use to really show off the surround sound system.
And that's there's
those
stuff
fight
like that.
Sequences.
Yeah, I mean, surround sound can be extraordinarily immersive and take you that much deeper into the film. But dude, stereo is an excellent place to start, and you know, you might not even be thinking about surround sound. I think you got a fantastic start there, Mikkel, and enjoy the snot out of it. Andrew, aka at AJ Ruth, tweets, well, to us at AVXL, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, what's the best short throw projector that is not DLP for under $3,000? And there isn't one. Short throw projectors, they tend to be either like under $1,500 or in the $25,000 to $50,000 range. Sony has...
Value, generally.
Yeah. Sony has a crazy... their LSPX W1S 4K Ultra Short Throw Projector. It looks like a really stylish baseboard heater. You shove it against a wall, you get a 147-inch image. And I don't mean to be mean by saying it's a really stylish baseboard heater, but it sort of has these long, thin panels, and the projector kind of pops up against the wall. That's a fantastic, amazing-looking thing.
Well, over at Best Buy right now, let's see here, they have that $25,000 short-throw laser from Sony. And that's a true 4K projector, too, which, you know, that's why it's $25,000 as well. But this is their second gen. Actually, the VPL VZ1000ES. Yes. $24,999.
Yeah.
I've seen this functioning at trade shows and in real life. And it is a terrific projector.
It's also a, you know, you can buy a really badass car for $50,000.
Or
so,
25 grand for the 1,000 model.
For the 1,000 model.
So, but yeah, for short throw, most of them, this in particular for the Sony is a three-chip SXRD style projector,
right.
Liquid crystalline silicon style technology. Yeah. But most are single chip DLP value.
LG's PF1000U laser. That'll do up to 100 inches. But that's the thing, though, right?
But LED or laser?
I think it's laser going through, I believe, DLP technology.
Okay.
It's only got 1,000 lumens. So ambient light's going to kill you, especially, you know, if you're around 60 inches, not too bad. 100 inches, boy, you're going to want curtains, blackout curtains. You know, on the upside, that laser inside of it promises like 30,000 hours of life. Compared to the like 6,000 hours for a typical projector,
you're not
going to
have a
long lived projector
pop on you.
Yeah,
instant turn on and turn off. That's the beauty.
ViewSonic's PX800 HD 2,000 lumens. It'll cover like 70 to 150 inches. It's $1,300 again. DLP. Optoma's GT5500 is a whopping 3,500 lumens. They'll give you probably a very bright 100 inch image from 13 inches away from the wall. You know, one thing we should point out is, you know, the short throw projector can create almost as many issues as it solves, right? You don't have a projector hanging in the middle of the room. You don't have
True.
To very carefully shop for a projector that you can, you know, fit into your bookshelf.
You generally can't walk in front of the light path either, which
yeah.
is nice.
Well, that's, you know, we got like 8-9 foot ceilings, 9 foot ceilings. But, you know, I ceiling mount the projector and you have to be pretty close to the screen to interrupt the beam from the projector to the screen. Right. But, you know, with a short throw projector, you have to have a console or a piece of you can put it on the floor.
Totally.
In front of the
you could
it's going to be a little low you'd be looking down at the center
if you're
of
dealing
image.
With a fixed size screen it's going to be in one specific
yeah.
spot you're going to have very little ability to move
yeah.
it around so it may
there
be
may be
exactly
some keystoning
11
adjustment.
And a half inches from the wall
yeah
it has to be there in order to do the image right
yeah there's like no lens shift you're gonna basically figure out where that image hits the wall then you're gonna mount your screen there. And you're probably going to have a dedicated screen on your wall because it's so close. You're not really going to have the room to do a projector that disappear or a screen that disappears when you're not watching.
Pairing
the
these though with a light rejecting design is
yeah.
some of the best imagery I've seen in terms of just a bright room projector setup. If the projector is paired with a screen that can block or minimize the light that's coming in from all the sides except for say the bottom. Where that projector is shining up from, this is where a lot of these systems really kind of jump out, and suddenly it's like, hey, I can really get away with doing a 100-inch projection in a room with actual real lighting in it, and it doesn't look bad. And those were some of the demos I saw with Hisense and their mm-hmm. short throw. Is it a 4K laser they have coming out this year for $7,000? Maybe that's probably not the list price. that's probably my wishful thinking price, but
it's a good wishful thinking price.
But the other issue I see with a lot of the projectors today, unless you get into the higher end, is that they're all Rec 709 projectors. None of them are doing wide color gamut until you start to spend a little bit of money. So
Yeah. That's
something else too. If you're eyeballing maybe not HDR, but at least wide color gamut support in a projector, that's the current premium feature that I'm seeing in the very, very best. So something to keep in mind.
Yeah, but in terms of non-DLP short throw projectors under 3,000, as far as we know, no such creature exists.
Yeah.
So our apologies. We got a question. Josh from New Jersey writes, hey, Patrick and Robert. Actually, he writes, hey, Robert and Patrick. I've been doing research and wanted to step up my calibration skills. When trying to research LUT boxes and 3D LUT calibration, there's a lot of confusing information. Can you please explain a typical LUT box setup in terms of TV calibration, mainly those of us with AVRs and TV setups, and why or why not it might be a good or bad idea versus calibration with just a meter? Are there affordable options? Is a LUT box even needed on higher-end TVs, which may have more control over settings? Thanks, Josh from New Jersey. And if you're sitting here staring at your speakers or listening on your headphones with the puzzled look on your face going, you know, WTF is a LUT, that's a lookup table. And mixinglight.com/color-tutorial/understanding-LUTs A lookup table, or LUT, is a mathematically precise way of taking specific RGB image values from a source image and modifying them to the new RGB values by changing the hue, saturation, and brightness values of that source image. A LUT can be scientifically precise, such as moving from the sRGB color space to the DCI-P3 color space. A LUT can also be used creatively to impose a specific look on a source image, such as the bleach bypass look.
Yep.
You know, so like if you dig around at Aja.com, you can find like their, you know, they've got a LUT box they sell to do inline color transformations.
That's exactly why you buy one.
Yeah.
It would sit between your, it would sit in the chain right before the display device.
Right.
Effectively, there is one line going from the display to this LUT box. Lookup table boxes are generally programmable in the sense that you still need a meter. You still need to be able to measure what's coming out of the TV. But instead of using the TV's built-in controls,
right,
you effectively leave it at default and then use this LUT box to adjust the output. And generally speaking, these lookup tables provide up to 100,000 points of correction possible. So you can do a very precise correction across the entire color palette.
So basically, you sit there, you've got your calibration tools.
You're hopefully doing this in software with a relatively fast meter.
Right. I mean, you know, you got your $6,000, $10,000 worth of calibration tools pointed at the screen. You're taking measurements, and then you are applying those measurements to the LUT table to better correct the image coming out of the screen.
Yep, and there are some pitfalls to it. Now, I will say right off the bat, most people do not need this box.
Right.
They don't need anything like it in their home theater setup. The preset calibrated mode on most premium TVs is going to be fine. Many professional monitors I deal with include integrated LUT support. Flanders Scientific, one of my favorite companies for pro monitors, they make it very easy for me to just connect my tools, measure what's coming off of that display, and get it configured either maybe for DCI-P3 color or for Rec. 709 or whatever, create an optimized output so that as that signal comes into that monitor, I have looked at it across the entire color space and made adjustments to get the error values to be fundamentally perfect. And that's the big deal about it. And it's nice having it built into a display because you have no separate box.
Right.
And then it's easy to create multiple profiles, like we were talking about, if you want to do a specific type of look on a display. Maybe you want it a little more punchy or something. The one pitfall I see most calibrators run into is that they fail to set that display up properly when dealing with a LUT box in the chain. Generally, you're going to reset the display to its defaults and not change it at all, and then find a preset that is best optimized for then the LUT box itself. Generally speaking, always select a display's widest color gamut. Don't ever use a Rec. 709 or a sRGB color space with a LUT box and then expect to be able to expand that beyond that. Or you want the color palette of the display to be far larger and then let the LUT box squeeze it back down to where it needs to be and control it properly. And those are the biggest problems I run into. Most of the time, though, yeah, folks really don't need it on the pro side. And also, too, this is another way of thinking about how you create a custom calibration for a monitor in software using ICC color profiles and things like that. LUTs are like the next step in terms of this, hopefully is directly addressable to the display itself, and the amount of correction that can be applied is far greater than you're going to get out of doing things like a two-point setup for white balance or even manual color controls and things like that. This can be very automated and to produce very consistent results, particularly if you're dealing with multiple consistent, the same brand of monitor over and over and over, you can develop just perfect output on these things.
I would say they tend to be almost always used in professional production environments, broadcast environments, or maybe if you are having your, you know, zillion-dollar home theater built.
I've seen them connected to even modestly priced displays, but I felt it was really unnecessary for a lot of it. And a properly set up display really doesn't need this kind of correction unless there's some specific issue going on. And otherwise, in the pro world, if you do have a monitor that supports programmable LUTs, get that thing calibrated, especially if you know what space you're working in. Like, yeah, I always work in HD video. Get that set up once and just know that what you're looking at is as good as it can get.
Right. without maybe buying a $100,000 projector.
That still won't look good right out of the box.
There you have it.
You still have to, depending on the screen and room lighting, blah, blah, blah.
We'd laugh, but we're dead serious about this. Oh, my goodness. Ask at avxl.com is the place to email Robert Heron and myself.
You can also
tweet at avxl.com or at Robert Heron or at Patrick Norton. I had a chance to talk to Odyssey co-founder and I want to say CEO. I hope I have that right. Sankar Thiagasamudram back at CanJam down in Los Angeles a few weeks ago. And because I've been blown away by Odyssey makes planar magnetic headphones, and they've done some incredible things with the technology. First of all, in advancing the quality of their big, giant, traditional planar magnetic headphones. And then last year, about this time last year, releasing the Sign, which is a sealed over-ear, a very tiny sealed over-ear, or a small, I should say, sealed over-ear planar magnetic. And then a few months later, releasing the iSign, which is the in-ear planar magnetic.
That's the one I'm thinking of. Looks like a spider web.
Looks like a spider web that plugs into your ear. Sounds amazing.
And beautiful.
I got a chance to talk to him, like, how, you know, because at CanJam, they announced that they would be doing an open version of the Sign on-ear planar magnetic, which, of course, is going to expand or open up the sort of the soundstage, if you will. But, you know, I was very, very curious. I'm like, how are you shrinking this technology? Stay tuned after we wrap up, and you'll hear that conversation with Sankar.
Oh, nice.
I hope you guys enjoy that. Odyssey's doing some pretty amazing stuff these days, and it was really interesting to get to talk to him. He had a bit of a cough, so hopefully we didn't get too much of that in the recording. It was fun stuff.
Good deal.
If you are new to AVXL, AVXL.com is the place to find all the older episodes of the show, and you should go there when you get a chance. All of our show notes are there, and if you haven't been there, HeronFidelity.com is where Robert writes about home theater technology and reviews televisions, and it is a source of awesome, and my main gig is a show called Tech Thing, TekThing.com, where it's like the Mickey Mouse Club for geeks.
Aww.
But don't tell Disney because they might sue me for saying that. So it's an enthusiastic weekly television show where we answer questions and talk about mostly computer and mobile technology. So thank you, each and every one of you, for listening to AVXL. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
We'll catch you next week.
We've been talking a lot about electrostatics, planar magnetics, dynamic headphones. We talked about the differences here on AVXL. And we had a chance to talk to Odyssey co-founder and CEO Sankar Thiagasamudram. And you're 2016 was mind-blowing for me. By the way, welcome to AVXL, Sankar.
Huh?
It's a welcome to AV.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
No,
thank you.
I'm launching this as if it's in the middle of a podcast, it's kind of non sequitur. But 2016 was a crazy year for Odyssey, at least for me as an outsider watching, because you went from full side planar magnetics, then you delivered the Sign, which was this tiny sealed or relatively tiny sealed on your planar magnetic, and then we turn around a few months later at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, and you deliver the Sign 10 and the Sign 20, which are the in-ear planar magnetics. And I was blown away because they sound fantastic. How do you take a big, you know, saucer-sized planar magnetic and start shrinking it down? What was the biggest challenge in delivering the Sign?
So around 2013, middle of 2013, we decided that we wanted to go from, we wanted to take the sound of our LCD headphones and see if we can expand the market a little bit and reach more wider audience. And one of the things that was immediately obvious is when you think about planar, they are heavy.
Right.
They are big because you have to move a lot of air. You need a lot of surface area. And, they are not the best of the design. All of them look a little bit clunky. So we decided in 2013 that we will make a conscious effort to address each one of them. Mm-hmm. So for the design, we partnered with BMW Design Works USA, and then they helped us redefine our language and make it as better looking as possible. Mm-hmm. And we had a great relationship with them so far. The second thing is, how do you make them lighter and how do you make them less bulky? So if you look at the planar headphones, you have the most of the weight comes from the magnets, the bulky magnets. For example, our LCD4 headphone contains 24 magnets,
right,
and each one of them is heavy. So what we did was we created a new type of magnet, magnetic circuit called the Fluxar, that actually doubles the flux density of the highest grade neodymium magnet. So that actually helped in reducing the weight. Now we can use half the magnet and get the same efficiency. Then when you have to make them smaller, you also have to make them compliant. You have to move the same amount of air, but using much less surface area. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that is to see, one of the other things that we do is, as a company, we make our own magnets, we make our own film. So we have this.
And you do all that in Orange County? Or?
So the film and the diaphragm is made in Orange County. The magnets are made in a facility that makes magnets, but according to our specification,
sure,
we design the magnets. And they make it for us. But we do control the end-to-end process for our headphones. So that allowed us to make, you know, we put in a lot of R&D into new types of film. Mm-hmm. So the LCD4 was the first recipient of this new film. We made a film that was almost half a micron thick and very compliant. Mm-hmm. So then it allowed us to, you know, and some of those research got back into our other headphones, like,
sure,
the Sign and DL8 and the iSign, that allows us to make this, reduce the size, reduce the weight. For example, the iSign is about less than 20 grams mm-hmm. Weight, right? So we can get the same quality now in a more portable package, because as we go more, as we try to get this to more mainstream audience, mm-hmm. it's important to make it aesthetically pleasing,
sure,
and also easy. So other thing that we did for that was to see if we could shrink and put all the electronics inside a lightning cable.
Pardon me. I mean, you talk about going mainstream, right? You know, we're here at CanJam 2017. A lot of feral audio nerdery going on here. You guys are launching a special version of the Sign 10.
iSign 10, yes.
The iSign 10. They sound as good or better as the Signs, so I keep trying to call them the Signs. My apology. The iSign 10, just for the Apple Store. Is there any audience like more mainstream than the Apple Store audience? I guess Best Buy.
Yeah, but if you look at it, Amazon maybe even, right?
Yeah.
But we think of not everybody coming to the Apple Store is going to try an Odyssey headphone,
mm-hmm.
but they sell an incredible number of headphones.
Sure.
And it gives us great exposure in a store. And with the Lightning and the other products, we can now get the digital output of an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it, it's not against the audiophile world. We create products,
sure,
for the audiophiles. We concentrate on that as well. But as we try to expand, we need to make sure that people feel comfortable wearing these things and also look good. So they don't want to strap an amplifier and a DAC and around their,
right,
player. They are not going to buy a DAP or anything, mm-hmm. right? And if you look at the market of a DAP, maybe it's 200,000 a year.
Sure.
We 250,000 a year. I don't know how much is the exact market of a digital audio player, but Apple sells 70 million iPhones every 90 days.
Right.
Right. So you have this incredible thing that people have already,
mm-hmm.
and could you have them take a step from what they are used to,
right,
in the Apple stores and get a high quality audio? We are not looking to get 10% of the market or 5%. We are,
sure,
looking for that 0.1% of the people who might be interested that we can expand to. So how do you do that and still get a great experience?
Mm-hmm.
So that fed into how do we take the digital output of the iPhone, create a DAC amp and a DSP so that, mm-hmm. you can feed it to the headphone so it's seamless for them.
Sure.
So if you know the Apple customer, everything has to work, right?
Yes.
It has to be so simple.
It just works.
It just works,
Steve's,
and it has
law.
To be super simple.
Right.
So, and the first application, we had to create an app for the iPhone to do that. And it had only one button, upgrade firmware, right? That's all it had, right? And so we tried to make it simple.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we did was we put the firmware for these lightning cables on the Amazon cloud.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you click a button, it downloads it. It all happens seamlessly.
Sure.
And it upgrades the firmware, and all it shows is a percentage of completion. And then you are done.
Right.
And so we had to make the effort to make it seamless, easy to use, all those things. And we are trying with the Apple Store and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Sign and EL8 launched in a limited number of stores. The iSign has a much wider launch because,
sure,
the price point is also significantly lower with the iSign, because it's $399 compared to $699 and $599. So we will launch on all Apple stores with the iSign 10 in the middle of May.
Nice. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
You mentioned that when you originally built the app, it had one button. And what did you add to the application?
We added an EQ. So because it looked really so initially we were the first ones to do the lightning connector cable, right? And the box itself has a significant amount of technology. It has an amp, a DAC, a DSP unit, so you can do processing on it. Then it has an A to D converter and two microphones. So with all these things in a small board, what if the iOS changes tomorrow? We need an app. So when we did the first initial MFI testing, both us and Apple realized, oh, we need an app for this. So quickly, we put together an upgrade firmware button. Mm-hmm. It looked really bland. So we put an EQ, 10-band EQ. But we think of it as a platform. Over a period of time, the DSP capabilities are significant in the chipset. So we plan to add other features so that people can, I don't have a timeline for it. Sure. Maybe crossfeed, for example. You know, those kind of things where people can manipulate it. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing about that having all these things outside the iPhone is it doesn't matter what player you use, Spotify or iTunes or anything. The audio comes out digitally and then you manipulate it. So you bypass the whole limitations of having to be worried about which app you're using and all that stuff.
One of the things I love about the application is that if you do choose, like, you know, I started getting into audio in an area where it was all about you're minimizing the signal path and you're eliminating devices and you never, you know, EQs are evil. And people are much more interested in EQ these days, especially in headphones, than they have been in years. But I love the fact that when you program the EQ, it sends the information, it stores the profile in the cable itself, so that you don't have to like wake up the app, launch the app, and have the app manipulate. It's nice that it's so self-contained because you program the cable, and if you pull it from one phone to another one, or your phone to your tablet, your settings are stored there.
Yeah, that was also a conscious decision we made, because if you make it too app-dependent, then the problem is we want people to show their headphones to other people.
Sure.
Like, you know, whatever settings you do, it has to carry over, right? So that was an obvious choice to make at that point. And we still haven't even used maybe 20. We are using only 20% of the DSP capabilities. We hopefully will make more things so it's a lot more obvious in future.
I'm laughing because for so many years, like, DSP and options were so defined, like, you can make your living room sound like Radio City Music Hall, which just never quite worked out, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and if you see, many people don't use it at all, right? They do not use this. If you see, I've seen other headphones have these features, listen to this in a concert hall or this, and most people never use this. But we know about 80 to 90% of the people who have our iPhones, the Sign headphones, or iSign headphones, use the app.
That's amazing.
Right? So, I mean, they have to use it anyway for the upgrade, but we haven't done too many upgrades on firmware, but people use it, and a lot of people tweak it on the, and if you see the forums, people put their own profiles and stuff and say, oh, I like this particular one for iSign. So, I mean, to us, it's, you know, the audiophile hobby is also a little bit of tweaking.
Yes.
Hopefully, we can get that tweaking things with the apps.
So, tweaking, one of my favorite words. When you guys design it, because I've watched, like, as you know, as you've gone from the large planar magnetics to debuting the Sign, and then, like I said earlier, I was just dumbfounded by the fact that you took the technology in the Sign, and then you made it so much smaller to do the iSign in ear. I mean, how did you guys shrink that so fast?
It took us a while. We have been trying to do this since 2014, right? So it's a gradual process. It's just that products came out into the market at almost the same time. But the Sign headphone itself was designed in 2014.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. So we have this, but it also the product. Making a prototype, an acoustic prototype, is one thing, but making a shippable product is another thing, right? So what we do is, the way we work with BMW design is, we make the acoustic prototype first. Mm-hmm. We make sure it works, because then at least, because many times we are making headphones that nobody has done, tried these things.
Right.
There is no in-ear planar before, right? Full-size in-ear, full-range in-ear planar. There is no even on ear planars are very few that right. actually do well. So what we do is we try to create a prototype that completely works. Mm-hmm. So, and then what we do is then we go to the design firm, in our case, BMW Design, and then we give them this thing and say, can you make this look a little bit nicer than this contraption that we have? So, and then we have a great working relationship with them. They are in in Southern California mm-hmm. as well. So the design center is made up of people who do, they design all the electric cars, the i3, the i8, and then they do all the Rolls Royces and the Mini Cooper there. And then you have these people who, they have incredible design things. Right. And one of their goals is to go in and see if they want to do fresh projects outside their outside the automobile stuff sure. to keep them fresh. So we get, we have one constant designer, but then we get different designers trying different things. And they are very patient with us because many times it's very hard to make our contraptions look beautiful. So and then it goes through an iterative process. Finally, we end up with something that works both ways. Then we have to tool it, mm-hmm. make it. So it takes about 12 to 18 months to go from an acoustic prototype. Acoustic prototypes are easy. You can sure. make them in 3 weeks, 4 weeks easily. But then to make them into a product, then you have to get all the certifications. It takes, the fastest we have ever gone to market is probably the iScience in about 9 to 10 months. Wow. But even then, the R&D effort takes longer.
Right.
Last week when Jude and everybody were there from HeadFi, we showed them all the prototypes we had made, about 120 physical prototypes of iScience before we actually went to BMW with a finished prototype.
What was the biggest challenge? 120, was it aesthetic? Was it placing the magnets? Was it?
No, it was, the biggest problem was the surface area of a planar is big.
Right.
Even for the in-ear.
How big is the diaphragm inside of
about
the
28 ISI? Millimeter or 30 millimeter.
Which is huge.
It was just huge for a planar, right? For a in-ear.
Sure.
But then you are now taking all that sound and trying to put it through a small nozzle inside your ear.
Right.
So that is the bigger problem because now you have something that's, if you right. just try it.
How do we get it from 28 millimeters down to like 3 7 or 4 millimeters?
6.8 okay. millimeter is the porthole size. Okay. So how do we do that with, because if you just try it, you will get tremendous amount of distortion.
Right.
And iSign is probably the least distorting of any in-ear ever, right? If you measure the in-ear performance of iSign, mm-hmm. It's less than 0.1% distortion. To compare it, normal in-ears would have something close to 1%, even the right. very expensive ones. So what we did was we designed a waveguide feature inside the funnel. Mm-hmm. And it's basically an extension of our phaser technology. So that basically shapes the frequency, reduces the distortion, and funnels the sound correctly. So that was the most critical part of our design. That getting that right alone took us over 6 to 7 months to final. So it's, since we don't have a reference, we can't just do a mathematical model and just try it, because what do we compare it against, right?
Right.
So we made a lot of prototypes. 3D printing is amazing. So we can just try something today. Works, doesn't work, try it again.
Do you design in SolidWorks? Or?
Yes, SolidWorks. Okay. We also have a program called ComSol, mm-hmm. which allows us to simulate the behavior of these things to see what, we have programs that, for example, for full-size headphones, we can almost know what would be the frequency response of the headphone before we even start making a prototype. But for in-ear, we haven't gotten with the models there yet. But SolidWorks, ComSol, and we can do a lot of optimization in ComSol.
One of the things you mentioned earlier when we were talking is you design the open version of the headphone before the closed version?
Yes. Yeah.
And you design them at the same time?
Yeah. So because open headphones always sound better because there's no reflection of the back wave. So we design the open headphones first. And then we have a baseline for that headphone. Okay, if we do not close it, if we do not do any modifications, this is as good as it gets.
Right.
Then you close it, you are going to get the reflections through the diaphragm, all that stuff. And then the goal is to make the closed headphone sound as close to our open headphone, reference headphones. Mm-hmm. So when we did the EL8 or the LCD XC, the LCD X came first, XC came second. Mm-hmm. Same with EL8 and EL8 close back, sign and this. So, but we released them depending upon the market perception a little bit later.
I laughed. It probably wasn't particularly funny to you at all, but I laughed when we were speaking earlier because you said you originally released, was it the EL8?
Yes.
The sealed and the open version. And everybody went, well, the open version sounds better, and then just disregarded the sealed version.
Correct.
What a pain in the ass.
Yeah. So unfortunately, you know, sometimes the when people try to write reviews, they contrast it, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of exaggeration going on there. Sure. Also to contrast it. So it's not like, okay, this is 90% of that mm-hmm. Headphone. Okay, this is like really bad, that's really good. That's the kind of reviews usually we get. And we learned when we did the EL8 open and the close back, mm-hmm. people started comparing A-B-ing them and then saying, this sounds really bad. But even if in it, you know, in comparison to the open headphone, you will always have some compromises you have to make with the closed headphone. You try to minimize it and eliminate most of the issues, but you will always have some compromises. So that is a big perception issue. So that we learned our lesson with the simultaneous release of those things. So now we do it more in a more measured way. We release one headphone at a time.
I noticed, so you released the sign last year, and you didn't call it like the closed sign or the open sign.
Yes.
What's the name of the new sign?
It's going to be called the Sign Deluxe.
The Sign Deluxe. Yes.
Yeah.
Is that going to be a limited edition?
Yes, we are thinking of it as a limited edition first because this, you know, at the price point, initially when Sign was designed, it was designed to go into the Apple Store mm-hmm. to lower our price point to a much wider audience.
Right.
And that audience is more interested in a closed back headphone. So it was the first headphone we released. Mm-hmm. But the Sign Open, many people listened to it and they were like, this is a great headphone. Why don't you guys release it also? So the feedback from people who had tried it allowed us to experiment with it. Now that we have shown it, we are going to release it as a limited edition, see what the feedback is, and then go on from there.
So the Sign currently sells for $449?
Yes.
And what will the Deluxe sell for?
The Deluxe is going to be $599, but the initial introductory phase, we'll still sell it for $499 for the time being.
So just to ask... Oh, go ahead.
For the limited edition.
Okay. The one of the things that sometimes I'll be like, these are $449 and they sound amazing. One of the things people don't realize is that you sell, what's the top of the line headphone you guys sell now?
LCD 4 for $4,000.
And $4,000. Well, that's much more reasonable than I was thinking.
No. I mean, we don't really go into the crazy $50,000 headphone range. But the LCD 4 is, mm-hmm. You know, there is a tremendous amount of technology that went into making it.
Yeah.
And recently there was an article by a very well-regarded sound engineer comparing the LCD 4 to his $60,000 mastering speakers.
Right.
And it actually, you know, he said the LCD 4 really, you know, was very good, and competing with in terms and even outperforming some of the other things of his $60,000 speaker setup. So what we found out is many, you know, about 10 to 15% of our user base is mastering engineers and sound engineers. So we get direct feedback from them many times.
And they're so subtle and gentle when they give feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is, you know, so, and we have many, many top, you know, people who use our headphones from not only here. And one day, you know, for example, one day we found out that I was watching the song from Lord of the Rings, the Hobbit movie.
Right.
And you can see in the movie, there's a small LCD 3 in the making of the thing. We were like, wow, how did they get it? And you can see Peter Jackson and everybody sitting there, and there's an LCD 3 in this frame. Then we called them up and they said, yeah, we use an LCD 3 for this thing. So, and when Brent Burge, their supervising sound engineer, uh-huh. was nominated for the Oscar for the movie, he came here, and I was like, I emailed him and said, you know, he came by to visit us, and he says they use our headphones for checking and all that stuff because it's super flat, it's mm-hmm. reference quality. So those headphones obviously cost more, but they are also very limited quantities. We don't make them in any kind of, you know, each one is handcrafted, meticulously made. We match the left and right to less than 0.5 dB. difference between the left and the right. And the diaphragm for LCD4 takes us about a week to make.
That's
right,
incredible.
Because it's a slow deposition process.
Is that, I mean, literally you have, I'm going to use the word plastic because I don't know the name of the material that you guys use and probably couldn't buy it even if I could pronounce it. But how do you actually get the grid? It's not a grid.
The circuit, right?
Yeah.
So if you think about it in a general term, a planar headphone is a flexible PCB. Right. So most techniques that we use come from the flexible PCB manufacturing things. So what we do is we initially cast the film. Mm-hmm. The film is made in, I think, 60 inches wide things. And about to make an initial run of film, we have to make about 30 feet of film. Right. So, but this film is incredibly thin.
Right.
So they cast the film. Then, depending upon the type of diaphragm we make, we have two or three different types that we have in production. We either laminate or vacuum deposit metal on top of them. Right. For LCD4, we deposit a metal, very, very thin layer of metal. And then what we do is we etch away. Under, you know, aluminum that or the metal that we do not need.
So you cover the entire diaphragm and then you
etch it away.
Goodness.
Because I mean, it's initial days we used to do the regular PCB process, like photoresist and chemical etching and stuff, and then we have moved away. So now we brought everything in house because it gives us much better quality control and we could control the whole thing. And we do the whole thing in-house. We have very precise proprietary etching methods that we use now.
So one question I want to ask before I let you go, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time. But again, you know, it was extraordinary for me because the signs deliver this huge, this tremendous, you know, planar magnetic experience. They're very, very small. And then you translated that into the iSign. And, you know, I was like, the iSign sell for $399, which is a fantastic deal, and I was just so frustrated because the iSign 20 would sell for $599. They seem to have a much more open sound stage, and the low end is just phenomenal. Like, I was just like, oh, if I buy these, I want to buy the more expensive ones. And I'm always frustrated when there's, like, to me, what was a huge audible difference. What's the physical difference between the iSign 10 and the iSign 20?
The physical differences are actually in the diaphragm and the driver itself, meaning the diaphragm making the driver. As I, you know, the force on the diaphragm depends upon the induction, the current density, and the length of the voice coil. The iSign 20s have a slightly different design where the voice coil is much, much longer. So the force on the diaphragm is, you know, more for the same magnetic field and the same driving force. So it's a lot more detailed. That's what your brain perceives as a lot more bass. The bass quantity is probably the same because both of them go flat to 10 hertz.
Right.
It's the acceleration and the force that translate into more detail. That I think that is the biggest difference.
So is
you
there,
perceive.
They're more, the name of the circuits that are etched onto the diaphragm.
The voice coil.
The voice coil. So it's basically a larger voice coil.
Yeah, the longer.
It's funny because it took me a minute because you said that, and I'm thinking, like, it's not a voice coil like I have copper around, you know, wrapped around a piece of. It's actually there is more circuit material on.
That's
the surface
one thing
of the
also,
diaphragm.
Yeah. So and that, since you have to, for every voice coil design, you also have to change the driver design. The driver design changes because how the diaphragm interacts a little bit. A diaphragm interacts with the magnetic field. So the voice coil itself is etched or printed in planar drivers.
It's amazing. I just, it's, I don't know. It's you know, I will say the iSign 10 sound amazing. I was just blown away with the level of detail and the I guess, you know, the detail at the low end.
Yeah, I mean, our goal was to, see, as I said, we don't have a reference. Our goal was to design the best sounding in ears possible. And we've measured literally thousands and thousands of in-ears over the period of two years as we were developing. And I can easily, safely say there is almost no other in-ear that even comes close to the distortion metrics of the iSign 10, let alone the 20. And it's very easy to verify. Anybody can measure it and do it. It's a... And I think one of the things that we are very happy about it is it sounds like an over-ear headphone. It doesn't low sound. The sound stage is big. The imaging is outside your head. It's not inside like a typical in-ear.
Right. The what comes next? Where do you guys move to next? Do you make the in-ears smaller? Do you redesign the stuff at the top of the line?
I mean, we eventually want to get them smaller and more easier. The iSense are still a little bit bulky for in-ear, even though we have miniaturized it. We have tremendous amount of R&D. Mm-hmm. Things that are coming out of R&D. So I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
But it'll be an interesting 2017 and 18.
Oh, my goodness. More products at lower prices or more Both. Stuff at higher end? Or just Both. Ask me when it's here?
Both.
Okay. Senkos, thank you so much for your
time. Thank you so much.